World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, with shortwave broadcasts direct from important overseas stations and reports from the leading news points in our own country, where CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news. Now, here is Bob Trout.
The president was buried today. The service at Hyde Park was simple, as the service yesterday in the White House had been. At 10 o'clock, the four guns began to boom, 21 times, the presidential salute. 45 minutes later, the bugler sounded taps. Now even the muffled drums are quiet. The president had gone home. The time for tears had ended, and the time for strength and fresh resolution had come. We take you now to Hyde Park, Tris Coffin reporting.
I stood by the grave in the bright sunlight of a cool spring morning as the last mortal remains of Franklin Delano Roosevelt were laid at rest. The plaintive notes of taps rang out over a hushed gathering of relatives, friends, and officials at the Roosevelt family estate. The services were held in the T-shaped garden, only a few yards from the president's study. A high hedge shielded the burial. The rose bushes laid out in neat plots were in bud. Clusters of violets spotted the carpet of green lawn. The sky overhead was clear blue. The gathering was small and hushed by mutual understanding. There were many famous faces, but they were all blurred by the common denominators of solemnness and sorrow. Mrs. Roosevelt and Anna Roosevelt Bodiger were dressed in black. They stood with General Elliott Roosevelt. President and Mrs. Truman were with Mr. Roosevelt's intimate advisor, Justice Burns. I saw many old friends of the president. Jim Farley, Steve Early, Bernard Baruch, the Cabinet, Military High Command, Supreme Court, and members of Congress. Mrs. James Roosevelt, the elderly cousin of the president, sat in a chair on the lawn. At her feet in the warm sunlight was Fala, Mr. Roosevelt's dog. The services began with the firing of a 21-gun salute. The only sound in the 10-second intervals between salvos was the chirping of a thrush high in the trees. In the distance, I heard the mournful sound of muffled drums. The coffin and its military escort were moving down the road. The band began to softly play the sad, majestic strains of Massenet's elegy. A child cried at the strange music. Through a gate in the hedge, I saw the guard of honor from West Point, young, sober faces, marching in slow, measured steps. The band changed to the Star-Spangled Banner, and then the soft, comforting chords of Nearer My God to Thee. The coffin was borne in by soldiers, preceded by a choir boy holding a golden crucifix. The Reverend W. George Anthony, rector of the Episcopal Church at Hyde Park, read the burial services. His snow-white hair was blown by the wind. His words at times were carried away. I heard these snatches. I heard a voice from heaven, "Our Father who art in heaven, grant him entrance into the land of light and joy. We give thee hearty thanks for the good example of thy servants." Dust to dust and earth to earth. The voice ceased. 11 cadets from West Point pointed their rifles into the air and fired 3 volleys. The crash of sound echoed for seconds. The flag was removed from the coffin and handed to Mrs. Roosevelt. The coffin was lowered gently into the ground. Franklin Roosevelt was at rest in his beloved gardens. The thrush was singing again. I return you to New York.
12 days ago, CBS correspondent Eric Severide was in Germany with the American Ninth Army as it crossed the Rhine. He returned to Paris and then London and has just arrived in this country. Now he has been assigned to San Francisco to cover the United Nations conference. The war correspondent will become a peace correspondent. Now for his first report since returning to this country, here is Eric Severide.
On the big transatlantic airplane, we were Americans. We did not dream that this would be our homecoming from the war. In the war, you think about your country a very great deal. A strong, simple picture takes form in your mind. The minor tones fade out. Then you see your home country as a resolute place, such a confident and happy place. Perhaps that is because you feel all around you in Europe uncertainty and that undercurrent of fear about the future. In Germany a few days ago, the soldiers seemed almost happy in the war. It was going so well and so fast. You could see that they knew the eyes of their homeland were fixed upon them. They knew their home was happy and proud over their achievement. And they had that inner contentment of knowing that because of what they were doing, all was serene and safe with their people at home. Nothing could happen there. So now the soldiers must feel a little bit cheated in their victory. It is a little like the young boy who makes his first touchdown and then discovers his father was not in the audience. They will go on, of course, but if they hoist soon the American flag over Berlin, it will stop at half-mast, and that is not the same. And yet, you know, it is almost more appropriate this way. The flags of all the civilized people of Europe have been at half-mast for years. Few of them will have much sense of victory when it comes. They will have a sense of great relief, but the cost in sorrow remains in their hearts. American soldiers now will have a little more in common with their comrades of other lands. When we boarded the gleaming airplane in the warm Scottish night, we had heard only rumors that the president was dead, a thing the mind just could not accept. As we settled down across the waste of Iceland, we peered through the little round windows. There was a thin curtain of driving snowflakes, and through it, we could see the American flag whipping and jerking in its unaccustomed place halfway up the pole. One didn't know quite what to expect as we neared the American coast. If all the land had been dark, we would not have been surprised. But the great seaboard cities sparkled and gleamed like tangled skeins of diamonds. There were Frenchmen and Dutch aboard going to Frisco. They rushed to the windows and caught their breath. The first bright, brave lights they had seen in 6 long years. And they had to come to America to see them. That wonderful face and voice which had expressed America to all Europe was gone. But the thing itself was still there. The substance was there. America, that is to say, the future, was there.
And now for a report from the American 12th Army Group headquarters, we take you to Germany, Bill Schadell reporting.
Second, Wolf. Yesterday, I returned from a 3-day tour of the 3rd Army front. As a sample of the vast area already occupied and the speed and scope of our advance, TBS European Chief Edward R. Murrow and I traveled 600 miles in 48 hours just to see one small portion of the front. That was from the nearest reliable transmitter to the front and return. It included a visit to Weimar, which had surrendered only a few hours previously, and it came into Geneva along with the infantry. A tour of Buchenwald, one of Germany's 4 largest concentration camps, and an attempt to catch up with one of those spearheads of the 4th Armored Division.
In an attempt to describe for you the scenes at Buchenwald,
if you heard Mr. Murrow's broadcast an hour ago, you will have some idea of the guilt which lies heavily on the heads of the German people. I can only say that Mr. Murrow used considerable restraint in his description of the horror, the indescribable misery concentrated there. Jena was a typical conquered city with the usual confusion. The doughboys going from house to house removing any possible snipers, the civilians complying with the order to turn in all weapons, others just curiously watching the flow of American tanks, half-tracks, jeeps through the streets. And everywhere the other nationalities, Czechs, Poles, Russians, French, jubilant over their newly won freedom. There was a very laughable scene going on in Weimar. These people, slaves, deprived of everything but bare food for existence and work, had found a freight yard, a few boxcars filled with clothing. They had swarmed over these cars, dragging out German uniforms, civilian suits, bolts of cloth, and of course were arguing over it. The arguments were settled mainly by force, though not seriously, so long as no German was involved. And the Germans knew better than to argue with their former slaves. And why shouldn't they lose? The wonder to me is that there is so little of it. It's small payment for long years of servitude and deprivation in a land that appears to have had its ill-gotten plenty, but denied it to all but the master race. This is Bill Schadell at General Bradley's headquarters, returning you now to Admiral in New York.
For a summary of developments on the Western Front as well as in France, we take you now to Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
Here in Paris, this too is a solemn day of mourning and memorial services for President Roosevelt. General de Gaulle, his cabinet, the diplomatic corps, and a host of Allied soldiers and French civilians went to Notre Dame today to honor the memory of a great man. All the dignitaries were present. But the greatest tribute was from the thousands of simple, ordinary folk who were there because they had lost someone they loved. The German army today is pulling itself together again for another last-ditch stand. On the Berlin front, they have forced us to give up one bridgehead across the Elbe River near Magdeburg. In the north, they're establishing a line to hold the British and Canadians away from the North Sea in the ports of Emden, Bremen, and Hamburg. In the south, they are fighting the First Army off from Leipzig. Only the Third Army has been able to press on at its usual blitzkrieg pace. The Third Army is within 13 miles of the Czech frontier now, and they're within 7 miles of the big communication center of Chemnitz. Although the Ninth Army has lost one of its bridgeheads across the Elbe, there is still another one further south from Magdeburg, which is all right, and is, in fact, continually expanding. The rest of the Ninth Army is closing up to the line of the river due east of Berlin. Back in the Ruhr pocket, those parts of the First and Ninth Armies left to deal with it have joined and split the pocket in two. Incidentally, since we closed that pocket at the beginning of the month, we have taken 143,000 prisoners out of it, and they're still coming. Speaking of prisoners, we've taken nearly 550,000 this month alone. Yesterday was the biggest day of all, when we counted well over 90,000. Operations began this morning to clear the German pockets from the mouth of the Gironde River and thus free the great port of Bordeaux. Yesterday and today, this was the target of 2,300 American heavy bombers, and it's also being bombarded by a big task force of the French Navy. We hold Bordeaux, but we can't get in there as long as the Germans control the river mouth. Bordeaux is the least damaged of the big French ports, and we should be able to use it as soon as we can get in. In an order of the day to the French Army, American artillery, and FFI engaged, the French commander, General de Larmenas, said, "You are fighting to free the port so that France will have enough to eat this winter." This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
And now for a summary of the news in Britain, we take you to London. Larry Lesser reporting.
The flags flew at half-mast over another Hyde Park today.
Here in London's Hyde Park, the crowd sauntered past the soapbox speakers, and thousands of them paused to listen in the April spring weather to eulogies of the late president. And groups of young American soldiers in wax gathered in small knots here and there among the throngs of Britishers and talked about the only president most of them have ever known. And then about their new commander-in-chief. Already there's a growing feeling of confidence in Britain over President Truman. All Britain was asking the question, what happens now? And they got one of the answers in President Truman's request to Moscow that Foreign Commissar Molotov attend the San Francisco conference. Premier Stalin's ready agreement has lifted the heart of Britain. They are heartened here by their sensing that President Truman has already taken a sure grip on the reins. And now that feeling of international loneliness is passing. They know now that the great three-power understanding, accomplished only through the blood and tears of war, is not to be lost in a day because of the death of one of its leading spirits. From Britain today, another armada of American fortresses and liberators made the long flight to Bordeaux on the Bay of Biscay. 1,300 of these unescorted heavy bombers battered the Germans in the Gironde pocket for the second day running. They were assisting the long-awaited sea and air attack to free the French port. French troops began the assault on the ground, while French warships bombarded German strong points at the mouth of the Gironde. Today, the American heavy bombers used a new and terrible bomb for the first time. It's a specially constructed firebomb containing a highly inflammable liquid. A detonator explodes each container as it hits the ground, scattering the flaming liquid over a 60-yard area. Today, the fortresses and liberators showered more than 460,000 gallons of flaming liquid on gun positions, trenches, and pillboxes, as well as high explosive bombs on the German guns on both sides of the Gironde estuary. These new fire liquid bombs may go a long way towards bringing the European war to a quicker end. If any German pockets continue to hold out after we have proclaimed VE Day, the holdout Germans may expect the threat of being burnt alive. The British Second Army captured a field marshal today. It was Field Marshal von Mackensen, 96-year-old retired veteran of the last war. They expected him to make a warlike statement, but all he asked was that they keep the freed foreign workers from stealing his chickens. And this is Larry Lesser returning you now to Admiral in New York.
President Truman is now on his way to Washington to take up the many problems facing him. For a review of what our new president can list among his first problems, we take you to Washington, Bob Evans reporting.
Here in Washington, Lafayette Park, across from the White House, and Constitution and Pennsylvania Avenues are virtually deserted today. Light showers and gray skies have settled over this capital, which still mourns the death of President Roosevelt. Church services are again being held in his memory. And at the Lincoln Museum on 10th Street, a joint memorial service is to be held at 3 o'clock to honor both presidents, Roosevelt and Lincoln. The martyred Lincoln died just 80 years ago today. With the late President Roosevelt now buried in the soil of Hyde Park, the eyes of the world turn to the future and to President Harry S. Truman, already aboard the Hyde Park special train, returning to this capital. On the shoulders of this 60-year-old Missourian, he will be 61 on May 8th, now rests the big job of winning the peace. Peace not only on the international front, but on the domestic front as well. How will he measure up? Friends of President Truman, and he has many, Republicans and Democrats alike, refer to him as a practical American. And as an example of the esteem in which he is held, Senator Homer Ferguson, a Republican of Michigan, says, as soon as the people realize his capabilities, they will rally behind him. Mr. Ferguson is a member of the War Investigating Committee, which Mr. Truman headed as a senator. To be described as a practical American these days is an accolade of no mean distinction. After all, practical Americans made this country great, and practical Americans are winning the war. President Truman already has displayed his practicality by prevailing upon Joseph Stalin to send his ace diplomat, Foreign Commissar Molotov, to the San Francisco conference. Mr. Truman doesn't want the importance of the meeting minimized, as it may have been, without top men from all nations. Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden is here to represent Britain. Mr. Truman also has shown his practicality by making moves toward getting along well with Congress. He set a precedent by taking luncheon at the Capitol Friday. It is expected that he will build up an even closer liaison when he addresses a joint meeting of Congress at 1 tomorrow afternoon, an address which will be broadcast by CBS. And when he holds his first news conference Tuesday morning, it is believed he will firmly establish his practicality in the minds of newsmen, readers, and listeners alike. When the time comes, which will not be far away now, for President Truman to appoint department heads and make cabinet changes, it is expected that he will place a high premium on men who can get along with Congress, and he will accept the advice of Congress in making his appointments. His first opportunity to put this plan into practice may come when Mr. Truman names a federal loan administrator, a post now vacant. It is a little early to predict cabinet changes, but it does seem clear that intimates of President Roosevelt, such as Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau and Attorney General Francis Biddle, would be permitted to resign if they show a desire to do so. It seems a foregone conclusion that Secretaries of War and Navy, Stimson and Forrestal, will stay on until war's end. Also, Interior Secretary Ickes, who was a favorite of President Truman when he was a senator. Secretary of Labor Perkins may resign, as she has long wanted to do. And after San Francisco, Secretary of State Stettinius may go, with strong possibility he will be succeeded by former Assistant President James F. Burns. Mr. Burns accompanied President Truman to Hyde Park at the President's request. Mr. Burns took along notes he had prepared at Yalta. There is a feeling here in Washington that Henry Wallace may stay on as Secretary of Commerce. His removal would be at the cost of liberal and labor support. Frank Walker may go as Postmaster General, with Robert Hannigan a possible successor. And Claude Wickard may leave the Department of Agriculture, with the War Food Administration to be brought back into the agricultural fold. Indications also are that many of President Roosevelt's so-called little cabinet, including Harry Hopkins, may be permitted to withdraw. Now back to CBS in New York.
The president has been buried. The simple service at his home in the field above the Hudson symbolizes the end of these tragic 4 days. There's no need to say that the final service is not the end of Franklin Roosevelt here on Earth. He did not leave on Thursday at Warm Springs, and he did not leave this Sunday at Hyde Park. It was not in his power to remain in life any longer, and it was not in his power to depart from the living. Only the living can decide whether he is to stay or to go, and the living made that decision long ago. When the people called upon him to lead, it was then that he abandoned his own personal life and lived in the hearts and minds of millions in America and even more millions on the other side of our frontiers. His personal life was sacrificed long before that Thursday afternoon, but he will live among those who called him friend as long as the people have life. The vast grief that has gripped the people of this nation and its friends abroad is a tremendous tribute to the president, and it is also a tremendous tribute to the people. Burial is a final act, and yet the service above the Hudson is final in only one sense. It was the ending of the 4 days of grief and shock. Since that Thursday afternoon, the nation and its friends abroad have been like one stricken family. There were things to do, prayers to be spoken, and music to be played. The drums had to be muffled, the flowers gathered, and the fresh spring earth turned. From Thursday to Sunday was a time devoted to the last services that can be given to a friend who is dead. Now that time is over. There are no more vigils to be kept beside the railroad tracks, no more bells to be tolled. It is not the end, but it is as if an interval were finished. On Thursday afternoon, what the world learned was that a journey had to be made from Warm Springs through Washington to Hyde Park, from the rough battleground of practical affairs to the secure place which history has been holding open for Franklin Roosevelt. It is often said that the greatness of great men is not perceived until they are dead. Obviously, that is a belief that is false as often as true. But it is true that greatness is not mortal. The qualities which the great have to give, they give perpetually. Their gifts are taken into the pattern of life, and they appear thereafter in the fabric of the lives of nations, renewing themselves as the leaves on the trees are renewed by the seasons. In times of strain, all nations turn to the great men in their past and the people who made them great. This gigantic war has been fought by millions living, supported by those who lived generations ago and who, in their turn, had fought for the same ends. Franklin Roosevelt has now joined those who helped to make the traditions and those who are traditions. Everywhere these last 4 days, men have been eager to do the things men must do for a friend in the interval between death and burial. The flags have been lowered and the photographs draped in black. The people have stood in the streets and have sat quietly at home and have wept publicly as well as in private. All this was proper in the appropriate time, and the appropriate time is now done. The interval is completed, and the president has reached the goal which destiny reserved for him and which the people willed that he should reach. Now it is for the living to think again of goals, the goals that lie within the reach of the living. Even in the midst of mourning, during the 4 days of sorrow, much has been said of the kind of memorial Franklin Roosevelt would like. There is little disagreement. All who have given thought to the monument that would be most fitting are agreed that the unfinished work must be completed, the victory won, the enemy defeated, and the enemy's power to threaten the free world destroyed totally. Often it has been said and written since Thursday that the conference at San Francisco must be worked out to a thoroughly successful end. Franklin Roosevelt's memorial is to be the organization of nations to preserve the peace the nations are now winning. There is, I think, a simpler way of saying the same thing. Franklin Roosevelt made friends. He had more of them than any other man. He made friends of whole nations of people. They were friends of his, and they are friends of ours. He worked unceasingly to unite this nation in the face of danger. And when the American people came together to fight off the enemy, we discovered that we were not alone. The unity had spread, and there were many nations of friends united in the same struggle. Since Thursday, the people of the United Nations have been united in grief. That they remain united in friendship, hope, and determination is all that any man, living or dead, would ask.
World News Today is brought to you each Sunday by Admiral Corporation. Listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you world news today by shortwave radio, direct from the leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Rakeley Building, Chicago.